"Well, what are you looking for?" asked Kabuo Miyamoto.
"A murder weapon," answered Art Moran. "We think you might be responsible for the death of Carl Heine."
Kabuo blinked a second time and dropped the hose to the deck. "I didn't kill Carl Heine," he insisted. "It wasn't me, Sheriff."
"Then you won't mind us searching, will you?"
Art Moran said, and stepped up onto the boat. He and Abel Martinson rounded the cabin and stepped down into the cockpit.
"You'll want to take a peek at this," the sheriff said, and handed Kabuo the warrant. "Meanwhile, we're going to start looking around. We don't find anything, you're on your way."
"Then I'm on my way," Kabuo answered, "because there isn't anything to find."
"Good," answered Art. "Now, cut your engine."
The three of them went into the cabin. Kabuo hit the kill switch beside the wheel. It was quiet now without the engine running.
"Have at it," Kabuo said. "Why don't you just take a load off?" replied Art. "Have a seat on your bunk."
Kabuo sat. He read the search warrant. He watched while the deputy, Abel Martinson, went through the tools in his toolbox. Abel picked up each wrench and examined it in the beam of his flashlight. He ran his beam along the galley floor, then knelt with a flathead screwdriver in his hand and pried ajar the battery well cover. His flashlight beam ran over the batteries and down into the recesses of the well. "D6s," he said. When Kabuo did not reply to this, Abel slid the cover back into place and put the screwdriver away. He turned his flashlight off.
"Engine under the bunk," he said.
"That's right," Kabuo answered.
"Stand up and haul the mattress," said Abel. "I'll have a look if you don't mind."
Kabuo stood, rolled the bedding aside, and opened the engine compartment hatch. "There you go," he said. Abel flicked his flashlight on again and poked his head into the engine compartment.
"Clean," he said after a while. "Go ahead and put your mattress back."
They went out onto the aft deck, Abel Martinson leading.
The sheriff was laying hands on things. Rain gear, rubber gloves, floats, lines, hose, life ring, deck broom, buckets.
He moved slowly, pondering each. He circumnavigated the boat carefully, checking the mooring lines on each cleat as he went, kneeling to look at them closely. For a moment he went forward and knelt beside the anchor, brooding in silence over something. Then he made his way back to the stern and tucked his flashlight into his pants waist.
"I see you replaced a mooring line lately," he said to Kabuo Miyamoto. "One right there on that second cleat to port. It's a brand new line, isn't it?"
"I've had that one around for a while," Kabuo Miyamoto explained. The sheriff stared at him.
"Right," he said. "Sure you have. Help me with this hold cover, Abel."
They slid it to one side and peered in together. The stink of salmon flew up at them.
"Nothing," said Abel. "Now what?" "Jump down in there," urged the sheriff. "Poke around a little."
The deputy lowered himself into the hold. He knelt and flicked on his flashlight. He went through the motions of looking.
"Well," he said, "I don't see nothing."
"There's nothing to see," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "You guys are wasting your time and mine. I need to get out there fishing."
"Come on out," said Art Moran.
Abel turned to starboard, his hands on the hatch combing. Kabuo watched while he peered up under the starboard gunwale at the long-handled gaff wedged against the wall.
"Look at this," Abel said.
He pulled himself out of the hold and grabbed it, a stout 3.5-foot gaff with a barbed steel hook on one end. He gave it to Art Moran.
"There's blood on it," he pointed out.
"Fish blood," said Kabuo. "I gaff fish with that."
"What's fish blood doing on the butt end?" Art asked. "I'd expect maybe to see blood on the hook, but on the butt end, where your hand goes, fish blood?"
"Sure," said Kabuo. "It gets on your hands, Sheriff. Ask any of these fishermen about that."
The sheriff took a handkerchief from the rear pocket of his trousers and held the gaff with it.
"I'm going to take and have this tested," he said, and handed it to Abel Martinson. The warrant allows me to do that. I wonder if I could get you to stay in tonight. Stay off the water until you hear from me. I know you want to go out and fish, but I wonder if you shouldn't stay in tonight. Go home. Wait and see. Wait there until you hear from me. Because otherwise, I'm going to have to arrest you now. Hold you in connection with all this.
I didn't kill him, repeated Kabuo Miyamoto. And I can't afford not to fish. I can't let the boat sit idle on a night like this, and
then you're under arrest, cut in Art Moran. Because there's no way I'm letting you go out there. In a half hour you might be in Canada.
No, I wouldn't, replied Kabuo. I'd fish, and then I'd come home, and by the time I did, you'd know that gaff of mine has fish blood on it, not Heine's. I could go out and get my salmon check with you in the morning.
The sheriff shook his head and slipped his hands to his belt, where he hooked his thumbs over the buckle.
No, he said, you're under arrest. Sorry, but we're going to have to hold you.
The investigation, it occurred to the sheriff, had thus far taken 5 hours. Sherlock Holmes, he remembered. Horace Whaley had laughed at his queasiness about the corpse, the peeled-back head, the bone splinters in Carl's brain. There was that diaper spread over Susan Marie's shoulder and her gloved index finger pointing out the church cake, that white finger inviting him to slide a mint between his lips. She'd collapsed on the stairs with her feet splayed out, the baby bottle beside her toes. All right, in the end he had played Sherlock Holmes, yes. It had been a sort of game. He hadn't really expected to find anything other than that Carl Heine had drowned, fallen into the sea like other men before him, and died because that was the nature of things. Art Moran was a believer in circumstances. To him, the occasional misfortunes of life were simply part of things. The misfortunes he'd seen in the course of his work remained painful and vivid in his memory, and because he had seen them for so many years, he knew that more would come his way. That was how things went. Island life was like life anywhere in this regard. Bad things, now and then, happened. Now he began to believe, for the first time, that he had a murder on his hands. He should have expected that sooner or later the course of things would bring him to this pass. He was satisfied to have conducted himself in the face of it professionally. He had pursued his investigation as well as anyone could have. Horace Whaley would not ridicule him now about playing Sherlock Holmes. It occurred to him, too, that for all his arrogance, Horace Whaley had been right. For here was the Jap with the bloody gun butt Horace had suggested he look for. Here was the Jap he'd been led to inexorably by every islander he'd spoken with. Art Moran looked into the Jap's still eyes to see if he could discern the truth there. But they were hard eyes, set in a proud, still face, and there was nothing to be read in them either way. They were the eyes of a man with concealed emotions, the eyes of a man hiding something. "You're under arrest," repeated Art Moran, "in connection with the death of Carl Heine."
Chapter 19. By 8:30 on the morning of December 7th, Judge Fielding's courtroom was filled with citizens who were thankful for the heat from the boilers. They'd left damp overcoats hanging in the cloakroom, but still carried the smell of snow in their hair and on their pants, boots, and sweaters. Ed Soames had again turned the heat up. He did so because the foreman of the jury had reported that certain of the jurors had passed a cold night in the Amity Harbor Hotel. Groans from the hapless radiators, coupled with the slamming of the wind against their windows, had kept them awake through the dark hours. They had been sequestered on the second floor, and had speculated before going to bed, said the foreman, that the snowstorm would interrupt the trial. They'd been sleepless, most of them, and had shivered in their beds while the storm rattled the hotel. Ed Soames apologized to the members of the jury for the inferior nature of their accommodations,
and pointed out to them the urn of coffee in the anteroom, which they were welcome to serve themselves from, the coffee was hot, at any time during the day's recesses. He showed them, as he had the day before, a cabinet inside which 14 coffee cups hung on angles from brass hooks. He pointed out the sugar dispenser and apologized to them for the fact that there was no way to make cream available. Peterson's had run out. He hoped they could make do despite this. The foreman indicated that the jurors were ready, so Ed Soames led them to the courtroom. The reporters found their places. The defendant was brought in. Eleanor Doakes took her seat at the stenograph. Ed Soames asked all of them to rise, and as they did so, Lew Fielding emerged from his chambers and strode to the bench as if no one were present. As always, he looked disinterested. He propped the weight of his head against his left fist and nodded at Alvin Hooks. "A new day," he told him, "but still your day in court, Mr. Prosecutor. Have at it. Call your witness." Alvin Hooks rose and thanked Judge Fielding. He was fresh-looking and clean-shaven, neat in his serge suit with its exaggerated shoulders. "The state calls Dr. Sterling Whitman," he announced, and then a man stood up in the gallery whom nobody had seen before, passed through the low gate and approached the witness box, where he was sworn in by Ed Soames. He was tall, 6'5" at least, and seemed too large for the suit he wore. A large portion of each shirt cuff showed, the coat bunched at the armpits. "Dr. Whitman," said Alvin Hooks, "we thank you for battling the elements this morning in order to give your testimony. I understand that only a handful of mainlanders were brave enough to travel the waters to San Pedro on the 625 ferry run. Is that correct, sir?"
"That's right," said Dr. Whitman.
"There were six of us." "A thrilling ride through a blinding snowstorm," added Alvin Hooks.
"That's right,"
repeated Dr. Whitman. He was entirely too large for the witness box, and had the appearance of a stork or crane packed into a crate.
"Dr. Whitman," said the prosecutor, "you are a specialist in hematology employed by the Anacortes General Hospital, is that correct? Do I have that right?"
"That's correct."
"And you have been employed there for how long?"
7 years.
"And during this time, doctor, what precisely has been the nature and content of your work?"
"I've been a hematologist for the past 6.5 years. Strictly a hematologist."
"A hematologist," said Alvin Hooks. "A hematologist does what exactly?"
Dr. Whitman scratched the back of his head, then above and below the left stem of his glasses.
"I specialize in the pathology and therapeutics of the blood," he said. "Mostly blood testing and analysis. I consult with attending physicians."
"I see," said Alvin Hooks. "So for 6.5 years it has been your profession, let me find a way to put this simply, to perform blood tests and to analyze the results of those tests, doctor. Is that correct?"
"In a nutshell," said Sterling Whitman.
"Very good, then," said Alvin Hooks. "Now, Dr. Whitman, could we accurately characterize you as an expert in the matter of blood testing? Given your 6.5 years of experience, would you say you have gained a degree of expertise in, for example, determining human blood type?"
"By all means," said Sterling Whitman. "Blood type is a standard matter, a standard procedure for any hematologist, typing blood."
"All right," said Alvin Hooks. "On the evening, the late evening of September 16th of this year, the sheriff of this county brought you a fishing gaff, did he not, and asked you to test a bloodstain he found on it. Is that correct, Dr. Whitman?"
"It is."
Alvin Hooks swiveled and looked at Ed Soames. Ed handed him the fishing gaff.
"Now, Dr. Whitman," said the prosecutor, "I'm showing you what has already been admitted into evidence as State's Exhibit 4B. I'm going to hand it to you and ask you to look it over."
"All right," said Sterling Whitman.
He took the gaff and examined it, a long-handled gaff with a barbed hook at one end, tagged as admitted around the butt.
"Okay," he said. "I've looked at it."
"Very good," said Alvin Hooks. "Do you recognize this fishing gaff, Dr. Whitman?" I do. It's the one Sheriff Moran brought in on the evening of September 16th. It was bloodstained, and he asked me to do some tests on it.
Alvin Hooks took the gaff and placed it on the evidence table in full view of the jurors. Then he selected a folder from among his papers and returned to the witness stand.
"Dr. Whitman," he said, "I'm now handing you what has been marked as State Proposed Exhibit 5A. Would you please tell me whether you recognize it, whether you can identify it for the court?"
"I can," said Sterling Whitman. "It's my investigative report, the one I wrote after Sheriff Moran brought me the fishing gaff."
"Examine it for a moment," said Alvin Hooks. "Is it in the same condition as it was when you prepared it?"
Sterling Whitman went through the motions of turning pages.
"It is," he said after a moment. "It seems to be, yes." "And do you recognize your signature thereon?"
"I do."
"Thank you, Doctor," Alvin Hooks said, and took the folder in his hand again. "The state moves the introduction of Exhibit 5A, Your Honor."
Nels Goodmanson cleared his throat.
"No objection," he said.
Lou Fielding admitted the exhibit. Ed Soames, with a flourish, stamped it. Then Alvin Hooks returned it to Sterling Whitman.
"All right," he said. "Now, Dr. Whitman, I'm returning to you what is now in evidence as Exhibit 5A, your investigative report concerning this fishing gaff, among other things. Would you please summarize for the court your findings?"
"Certainly," Sterling Whitman said, pulling uncomfortably at a cuff. "Number one was that the blood on the fishing gaff I received from Sheriff Moran was human blood. It reacted immediately to human antibodies. Number two was that the blood was of a sort we can describe as B-positive, Mr. Hooks. I obtained a clear identification in this regard without any difficulties under a microscope."
"Anything else significant?" asked Alvin Hooks.
"Yes," said Sterling Whitman. "The sheriff asked me to check our hospital records as to the blood type of a fisherman named Carl Heine, Jr. I did so. We had the records on file. Mr. Heine had been admitted after the war at our hospital for a series of physicals, and we had obtained his medical records. I looked these over and have included them in my investigative report. Mr. Heine's blood type was B positive."
"B positive," said Alvin Hooks. "Do you mean to say that the blood of the deceased matched the blood found on the fishing gaff?"
"Yes," said Sterling Whitman. "It did."
"But, Dr. Whitman," said Alvin Hooks, "many people must have this type of B-positive blood. Can you say with any certainty that it was Carl Heine's?"
"No," said Dr. Whitman, "I can't say that, but let me add that B-positive is a relatively rare blood type. Statistically rare, 10% of Caucasian males at best."
"One out of every 10 Caucasian males, no more?"
"That's right."
"I see," said Alvin Hooks. "One out of 10.
"That's right," said Sterling Whitman.
Alvin Hooks crossed in front of the jurors and approached the defendant's table.
"Dr. Whitman," he said, "the defendant's name here is Kabuo Miyamoto. I am wondering if his name appears in your report."
"It does."
"In what regard?" asked Alvin Hooks.
"Well, the sheriff asked me to check his records, too. As long as I was checking on Carl Heine, he asked, could I bring out Miyamoto's records? I did so and examined them at his request. Again, service medical records were available. Kabuo Miyamoto had been typed upon entering the service as O-negative. He has an O-negative blood type."
"O-negative?"
said Alvin Hooks. "That's right, yes."
"And the blood on the fishing gaff that Sheriff Moran brought you, the one he found while searching the defendant's boat, the one you held in your hands a moment ago, was B positive, doctor?"
"Yes, B positive."
"So the blood on the gaff was not the defendant's?"
"No."
"It was not salmon blood?"
"No."
"It was not fish blood or animal blood of any kind?"
"No."
"It was of the same type as the deceased's, as Carl Heine, Jr.?"
"Yes."
"A blood type that you would characterize as rare?"
"Yes."
"Thank you, Dr. Whitman. That's all."
Nels Goodmanson now tottered to his feet in order to cross-examine Sterling Whitman. By the morning of this second day, he had become an amusement to the newspapermen, who smiled to themselves each time he cleared his throat, and at his awkward attempts to stand or sit. He was an old man in suspenders, one useless eye wandering loose in its socket, poorly shaven wattles of skin at his throat, raw, chafed, and pinkish folds with sparse silver bristles poking out of them. Yet though Nels Goodmanson was at times vaguely laughable, the reporters fell serious when he passed in front of them and allowed them to see up close how his temples pulsed, the depth of the light in his good eye.
"All right," said Nels. "Dr. Whitman, sir, do you mind if I ask you a few questions?"
Sterling Whitman said he didn't mind at all. That was what he'd come to San Pedro for.
"Well, then," said Nels, "about this fishing gaff. You say you found blood on it."
"Yes," said Sterling Whitman. "I've testified to that effect. Yes, I did."
"This blood," said Nels. "Where exactly did you find it?"
He picked up the gaff and brought it to the witness.
"On what part, Dr. Whitman? The butt end? The hook?"
"The butt," the doctor answered. "This end," he pointed, "opposite the hook."
"Right here," said Nels, and put his hand on it. "You found blood on this wooden handle?"
"Yes."
"It hadn't soaked in?"
Nels Goodmanson asked.
"Wouldn't wood of this sort absorb blood, doctor?"
"Some soaking had occurred, yes," said Sterling Whitman. "But I was still able to obtain a blood sample."
"How?"
said Nels, still holding the gaff. "By scraping. It's the procedure with dried blood. You have to scrape."
"I see," said Nels. "You used a blade, doctor?"
"Yes."
"You scraped it onto a microscope slide? You placed the slide under a microscope?"
"Yes."
"And you saw what? Blood and wood scrapings?"
"Yes."
"Anything else?"
"No."
"Nothing. Only blood and wood scrapings?"
"That's right."
"Doctor," said Nels Goodmanson, "were there no bits of bone, or strands of hair, or particles of scalp on this fishing gaff?"
Sterling Whitman shook his head firmly.
"None," he said.
"It was just as I have said, as I testified, as I wrote in my investigative report, blood and wood scrapings only."
"Doctor," said Nels, "does this seem odd to you? If this fishing gaff were in fact used to inflict a head wound, would you not expect to see evidence of that in the shape of, say, strands of hair, or bits of skull bone, or particles of scalp? The sort of things we might normally associate with a head wound, Dr. Whitman, as evidence that the instrument in question had been used to inflict such a wound?"
"Sheriff Moran asked me to perform two blood tests," said the witness. "I did so. We determined that..."
"Yes, yes," Nels Goodmanson cut in. "As you have testified previously, the blood on the gaff was of the type known as B positive. No one is contesting that, doctor. What I want to know is, to the best of your knowledge, as a man who has for 6.5 years made his living looking at blood under a microscope, would you not expect to see hair or bone or scalp particles as well as blood if this gaff were used to inflict a head wound? Would you not, doctor? Would it seem logical?"
"I don't know," said Sterling Whitman.
"You don't know?"
asked Nels Gudmundsen. He still carried the gaff in his hand, but now he perched it on the ledge of the witness box between himself and the expert hematologist.
"Doctor," he said, "the coroner who examined the deceased in question included mention in his report of, if I remember it correctly, a secondary and minor laceration of the right hand extending laterally from the fold between the thumb and forefinger to the outside of the wrist. A cut on the palm, in other words. An ordinary cut on Karl Heine's right palm. Would it be possible, Dr. Whitman, that a cut like this, if the hand were wrapped around the butt end of this gaff here, that a cut like this might have caused the B-positive blood you spoke of to soak into the wound? Would that be possible, Doctor? Possible!"
"Possible, yes," said Sterling Whitman. "But I don't know anything about that. My only job was to perform the blood tests that Sheriff Moran asked me to perform. I found B-positive blood on this fishing gaff. How it got there, I have no idea."
"Well," said Nels Gudmundsen, "it's good of you to say so, because, as you've said, one of every 10 Caucasian males has blood of the B-positive type, don't they? And on an island like this one, that means probably 200 men, Doctor. Would that be about right?"
"Yes, I suppose. 10% of the island's Caucasian male population, it..."
"And isn't the percentage even higher, Doctor, for males of Japanese descent? A higher percentage of B-positives among the island's Japanese-Americans?"
"Yes, it is. Somewhere around 20%, but..."
"20%! Thank you, Doctor. That's quite a large number of island men we're talking about who have B-positive blood. But let's suppose, for purposes of argument, that the blood on the fishing gaff was, in fact, Karl Heine's, even though it might have come from hundreds of other men. Let's just suppose that, hypothetically, for a moment. It might have gotten there, it seems to me, in at least one of two ways. It might have come from the deceased man's head, or it might have come from this ordinary cut on his hand. His head or his hand, Doctor, either one. Now, given the fact that the blood is on the butt end of this gaff, where a person would normally place their hand, and given the fact that you found only blood there and no bone or skin or hair, Doctor, the probable evidence of a head wound, I would think. What seems to you to be likely? That the blood on the gaff, if it came from Karl Heine at all, came from his head or his hand?"
"I have no idea," said Sterling Whitman. "I'm a hematologist, not a detective."
"I'm not asking you to be a detective," Nell said. "I just want to know which is more probable."
"The hand, I suppose," Sterling Whitman confessed. "The hand, I guess, would be more probable than the head."
"Thank you," answered Nels Gudmundsen. "I appreciate your having battled the elements to come here and tell us so."
He turned away from the witness, made his way to Ed Soames, and handed him the fishing gaff.
"You can put that away, Mr. Soames," he said. "Thank you very much. We're done with that."
Three fishermen, Dale Middleton, Vance Cope, and Leonard George, all testified for the court that on the evening of September 15th, they'd seen Karl Heine's boat, the Susan Marie, with her net set on the fishing grounds at Ship Channel Bank. Furthermore, they'd seen Kabuo Miyamoto's boat, the Islander, in the same vicinity at approximately the same time. Ship Channel, Leonard George explained, was like many other places island men netted salmon, a narrow and limited seafloor topography, which forced you to fish within sight of other men and to move about with care, lest, in the night fog, general to Island County in early autumn, you motor across a set net and destroy it by winding it up in your propeller. That was why, even in the fog, Leonard had made out both the Susan Marie and the Islander between 8 and 8:30 at Ship Channel Bank. He recalled that as he cruised past, he'd seen the Islander come about, that 10 minutes later he'd come across the Susan Marie and seen that Carl Heine was backing net off his drum by motoring away from his jacklight. They'd been fishing, in short, the same waters, with Carl a bit farther toward the north and down current, 1,000 yards closer to the shipping lanes that gave Ship Channel Bank its name. Nels Goodmanson asked Leonard George if it was common among gillnetters to board another's boat at sea. "Absolutely not," replied Leonard. "There aren't many reasons why a guy'd do that. If you stalled out and somebody's bringing you apart, maybe that's about it, no other reason. Maybe if you was hurt or broke down or something. Otherwise, you don't tie up to nobody. You do your job, keep to yourself."
"Do men argue at sea?"
said Nels.
"I've heard they do, that gill-netters do. Are there arguments out there, Mr. George?"
"You bet there are," said Leonard. "A guy gets corked off, he—"
"Corked off?" interrupted Nels. "Can you explain that for us, briefly?"
Leonard George answered that a gill-net was constructed to have a top and a bottom, that the bottom of the net was called the lead line. Bits of lead were crimped onto it in order to weight it down, and that the top was known as the cork line. Cork floats allowed it to stay on the surface. So that, from a distance, a gill net appeared as a line of cork with the stern of the boat at one end and a warning jacklight at the other. When a man set his wall of net up current from your own, he'd corked you off, stolen your fish by getting to them before they could get to you. It meant trouble, said Leonard. You had a pickup, motor past him, and set your net somewhere up current, in which case the other guy might decide to play leapfrog and force both of you to waste your fishing time. Still, in all of this, Leonard pointed out, no man ever boarded another's boat. It wasn't done. He'd never heard of it. You kept to yourself unless you had some kind of emergency and needed another man's help. Alvin Hooks called Army First Sergeant Victor Maples to the stand after that morning's recess. Sergeant Maples wore his green dress uniform and the insignia of the 4th Infantry Division. He wore his expert marksmanship and combat infantryman's badges. The brass buttons on Sergeant Maples's coat, the insignia on his collar, and the badges on his chest all caught the meager courtroom light and held it. Sergeant Maples was overweight by 35 pounds, but still looked distinguished in his dress uniform. The extra weight was nicely distributed. Maples was a powerful man. He had short, thick arms, no neck, and a pudgy adolescent face. His hair stood up in a razor cut. First Sergeant Maples explained to the court that since 1946, he had been assigned to Fort Sheridan, Illinois, where he specialized in the training of combat troops. Prior to that, he'd trained troops at Camp Shelby, Mississippi, before taking part in the Italian campaign in 1944 and 45. Sergeant Maples had been wounded in fighting on the Arno River. He'd taken a German round in the small of his back, which narrowly missed his spine, and had been awarded the Purple Heart on account of it. He'd also, he said, been at Livorno and Luciana, and seen the 442nd, the Nisei regiment to which the defendant had been attached, in action along the Gothic line. Sergeant Maples had, in his time, trained thousands of men in hand-to-hand combat. Hand-to-hand was his specialty, he said. He'd worked in other areas of basic training, but generally found his way back to it. Sergeant Maples recollected for the court his astonishment in early 1943 when the 442nd, composed of Nisei boys, began training at Camp Shelby. These were boys from the internment camps, enlistees headed for the European theater, and among them, Sergeant Maples recalled, was the defendant, Kabuo Miyamoto. He remembered Kabuo from among the thousands who'd come his way because of a peculiar episode. 10 squads of trainees had surrounded Sergeant Maples on the drill field at Camp Shelby one February afternoon, 10 squads composed of Nisei boys, so that he found himself in the midst of 100 Japanese faces while he explained the particulars of the bayonet. Sergeant Maples informed his trainees that it was the policy of the United States Army to preserve their lives until they reached the battlefield. That was why a wooden staff would be substituted for an actual weapon during drill sessions. Helmets would be worn as well. The sergeant began to demonstrate bayonet thrusts, then asked for a volunteer. It was at this point, he told the court, that he came face to face with the defendant. A young man stepped forward into the ring of trainees and presented himself to the sergeant, bowing slightly before saluting and calling out loudly, "Sir!" "First off," Sergeant Maples scolded him, "you don't have to salute me or call me sir. I'm an enlisted man just like you, a sergeant, not a warrant officer or a major. Second, nobody in this army bows to nobody. There's plenty of officers who'll expect a salute, but a bow? It isn't military, not American military. It isn't done." Sergeant Maples gave Miyamoto a wooden staff and tossed him a sparring helmet. There was something aggressive in the way the boy had spoken, and Sergeant Maples had heard it. He was vaguely aware of this particular young man who had built a reputation during basic training as a thoroughly eager warrior, ready to kill and businesslike every bit of the time. Maples had seen many such boys come his way, and was never cowed by their youthful swagger. He was only on rare occasions impressed or prepared to view them as his equal. "In combat, your enemy won't be stationary," he said now, looking the boy in the eye. "It's one thing to work out on a dummy or a bag, another to spar with a trained human being who represents more accurately live movement. In this case," he told the gathered recruits, "our volunteer will seek to avoid the model bayonet thrusts put to him this afternoon." "Yes, sir," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "No more, sir," Sergeant Maples replied. "That's the last time with that." He explained to the court how astonished he was, how thoroughly astonished, to find he couldn't hit the defendant. Kabuo Miyamoto hardly moved, and yet he slipped every thrust. The 100 Nisei trainees looked on in silence and gave no indication that they approved of either man. Sergeant Maples fought on with his wooden staff until Kabuo Miyamoto knocked it from his hands. "Excuse me," said Miyamoto. He knelt, picked up the staff, and handed it to the sergeant. Once again he bowed.
"There's no need to bow," the sergeant repeated. "I already told you about that."
"I do it out of habit," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "I'm used to bowing when I'm sparring somebody." Then suddenly he brought his wooden staff up. He looked Sergeant Maples in the eye and smiled. Sergeant Maples acquiesced to the inevitable and did combat with the defendant that afternoon. It lasted all of 3 seconds. On his first rush, the sergeant was swept off his feet, then felt his head pinned to the ground with the point of the staff. Then the staff was withdrawn. The defendant bowed and picked him up. "Excuse me, sergeant," he'd said afterward. "Your staff, sergeant." He'd handed it to him. After that, Sergeant Maples availed himself of the opportunity to study kendo with an expert. Sergeant Maples wasn't stupid. He told the court this about himself without a trace of irony. And so he learned all he could from Miyamoto, including the importance of bowing. Sergeant Maples became a master with time, and after the war taught kendo techniques to the Army Rangers at Fort Sheridan. From his point of view, as an expert in the ancient Japanese art of stick fighting, Sergeant Maples could say with certainty that the defendant was eminently capable of killing a man far larger than himself with a fishing gaff. In fact, there were few men known to him who could ably defend themselves against such an attack by Kabuo Miyamoto. Certainly, a man with no training in kendo had little chance of warding him off. He was, in Sergeant Maples' experience, a man both technically proficient at stick fighting and willing to inflict violence on another man. He had made, the record showed, an excellent soldier. No, it would not surprise Sergeant Victor Maples to hear that Kabuo Miyamoto had killed a man with a fishing gaff. He was highly capable of such a deed. Chapter 20. Susan Marie Heine had been a widow for nearly 3 months by the time of Kabuo Miyamoto's murder trial, but had not grown very much accustomed to it yet, and still passed long hours, especially at night, during which she could think of nothing but Carl and the fact that he had gone out of her existence. In the gallery, with her sister on one side and her mother on the other, dressed in black from head to foot, and with her eyes shrouded behind a chenille dot veil, Susan Marie looked mournfully attractive. She exuded a blonde, woeful distress that caused the reporters to turn in her direction and ponder the propriety of speaking intimately with her under the guise of professional necessity. The young widow's thick hair had been plaited and pinned up beneath her hat so that the alabaster neck Art Moran so much admired when Susan Marie poured coffee at church socials lay exposed to the crowded courtroom. The neck and the plaits of hair and the white hands folded decorously in her lap all stood in sharp contrast to her black mourning outfit and gave Susan Marie the air of an unostentatious young German baroness who had perhaps just recently lost her husband but had not, in the face of it, forgotten how to dress well, even when she dressed to suggest grief. And it was grief, foremost, that Susan Marie suggested. Those who had known her for a long while recognized that even her face had changed. The superficial among them attributed this to the fact that she'd neglected to eat heartily since Carl died. Shadows had formed just under her cheekbones. But others recognized it as a deeper alteration, one that involved her spirit. The pastor at the First Hill Lutheran Church had on 4 successive Sundays asked his congregation to pray not only for Carl Heine's soul, but for Susan Marie's deliverance from grief in the course of time as well. In pursuit of this latter end, the church women's auxiliary had provided Susan Marie and her children with a straight month's worth of hot suppers and casserole dishes, and Einar Peterson had seen to it that groceries were delivered to her kitchen door. It was through food that the island expressed its compassion for Susan Marie in her widowhood. Alvin Hooks, the prosecutor, knew well the value of a Susan Marie Heine. He had called to the witness box the county sheriff and the county coroner, the murdered man's mother and the bent-over Swede from whom the murdered man had planned to buy his father's old farm. He had proceeded to a variety of secondary witnesses, Sterling Whitman, Dale Middleton, Vance Cope, Leonard George, Sergeant Victor Maples, and now he would finish matters by presenting the wife of the murdered man, a woman who had already done much good merely sitting in the gallery where the jurors could view her. The men especially would not wish to betray such a woman with a not guilty verdict at the end of things. She would persuade them, not precisely with what she had to say, but with the entirety of who she was. On the afternoon of Thursday, September 9th, Kabuo Miyamoto had stood at her doorstep and asked to speak with her husband. It was a cloudless day of the sort San Pedro rarely saw in September. This year there had been an early string of them, though, a day of deep heat, but with an onshore breeze that tossed the leaves in the alders and even ripped a few loose to fall earthward. 1 minute it was silent, the next a rush of wind came up from off the water, smelling of salt and seaweed, and the roar of the leaves in the trees was as loud as waves breaking on a beach. A gust caught Kabuo Miyamoto's shirt as he stood on the porch, so that the collar of it brushed his neck for a moment, and the shoulders ballooned out, filled with air. Then the wind died, and his shirt settled, and she asked him to come in and sit in the front room. She would go, she said, to find her husband. The Japanese man had seemed uncertain about entering her house that afternoon. "I can wait on the porch, Mrs. Heine," he suggested. "It's a nice afternoon. I'll wait outside." "Nonsense," she replied, and stepped aside from the door. She gestured in the direction of the living room.
You come in and make yourself comfortable. Get out of the sun and sit, why don't you? It's nice and cool inside.
He looked at her, blinked, but took only one step.
Thank you, he said. It's a beautiful house. Carl built it, Susan Marie answered. Please come in now, sit.
The Japanese man passed her, turned to his left, and perched on the edge of the bench sofa. His back was straight, his demeanor formal. It was as if he considered making himself comfortable an insult of some kind. With a deliberation that bordered, to her thinking, on something stylized, he folded his hands together and waited at attention.
"I'll go after Carl," said Susan Marie. "It'll only take me a minute."
"Fine," said the Japanese man.
"Thank you."
She left him there.
Carl and the boys were out culling raspberry canes, and she found them down among the southward trellises, Carl cutting free the older stock, the boys filling the wheelbarrow. She stood at the end of the row and called to them.
"Carl," she said, "there's someone to see you. It's Kabuo Miyamoto. He's waiting."
They all turned to look at her, the boys shirtless and small against the walls of raspberries, Carl bent at the knees, his knife in hand, a giant with a russet beard. He closed the knife and slipped it into the sheath at his belt.
"Where?" he said. "Kabuo?"
"In the living room. He's waiting."
"Tell him I'm coming," said Carl,
and he swung both boys into the wheelbarrow and planted them on top of the culled canes.
"Watch out for thorns," he said. "Here we go."
She went back to the house and informed the Japanese man that her husband would be with him shortly. He'd been out among the raspberry canes working. "Would you care for coffee?" she added.
"No, thank you," replied Kabuo Miyamoto.
"It's no trouble," she urged. "Please have some."
"It's very nice of you," he said. "You're very kind."
"Will you have some, then?" Susan Marie asked. "Carl and I were planning on a cup."
"All right, then," said Kabuo. "Thank you, I will. Thank you."
He was still seated in the same position, perched on the edge of the worn bench sofa, precisely as she'd left him minutes before. Susan Marie found his immobility disquieting, and was about to suggest that he sit back and relax, make himself at home, get comfortable, when Carl came through the front door. Kabuo Miyamoto stood up.
"Hey," Carl said. "Kabuo."
"Carl," said the Japanese man.
They came together and locked hands. Her husband, half a foot taller than his visitor, bearded and heavy through the shoulders and chest, and wearing a sweat-stained T-shirt.
"What do you say we go out?" he suggested. "Take a walk around the property or something, get out of the house, go outside?"
"That sounds fine," said Kabuo Miyamoto. "I hope this is a good time," he added.
Carl turned and looked at Susan Marie.
"Kabuo and me are going out," he said. "Be back after a while, going to walk."
"All right," she said. "I'll put coffee on."
When they were gone, she went upstairs to check her baby. She leaned over the side of the crib and smelled the girl's warm breath and let her nose brush against the girl's cheek. From the window she could see her boys in the yard, the tops of their heads as they sat in the grass beside the overturned wheelbarrow. They were tying knots in the culled raspberry canes. Susan Marie knew Carl had spoken with Ole Jurgensen and had put down earnest money on Ole's farm. She knew how Carl felt about the old place at Island Center and his passion for growing strawberries. Still, she didn't want to leave the house on Mill Run Road with its bronze light, varnished pine boards, and exposed roof rafters in the upstairs room, its view of the sea beyond the raspberry canes. From the window of her baby's room, looking out across the fields, it was more clear to her than ever that she didn't want to move. She'd grown up the daughter of a hay farmer and shake cutter, a man who couldn't get ends to meet. She'd cut thousands of shakes, had hunched over a cedar block with a fro and a mallet, her blonde hair hanging in her eyes. She was the second of three daughters and remembered how her younger sister had died of tuberculosis one winter. They'd buried her on Indian Knob Hill in the Lutheran part of the cemetery. The ground had been frozen, and the men had difficulty digging Ellen's grave. It had taken the better part of a December morning.
she'd met Karl Heine because she'd wanted to meet him. On San Pedro, a woman with her looks could do such a thing if she did it with the proper innocence. She'd been 20 and employed at Larson's Pharmacy, where she clerked from behind an oak sales counter. One Saturday evening at 11:30, on a hill above the dance pavilion at Westport Jensen, she stood beneath the branches of a cedar tree, while Carl ran his hands up under her blouse and caressed her breasts with his fisherman's fingers. The woods were lit with lanterns, and far below in the bay, through the interstices of trees, she could make out the deck lights of moored pleasure boats. Some of the light came to where they stood, so that his face was visible to her. This was their third dance together. By now she knew definitely that she admired his face, which was large, weathered, and durable. She held his face between her hands and looked at it from a distance of 6 inches. It was an island boy's face, and at the same time mysterious. He'd been to the war, after all. Carl began to kiss her throat, so that Susan Marie had to throw back her head to make room for him with his russet beard. She looked up into the branches of the cedars and breathed in their perfume. And he moved his lips over her collarbones, and then down into the space between her breasts. She let him. She remembered clearly how she had let him, how it was not resignation as it had been with two other boys, one near the end of her senior year of high school, the other during the summer before this one. But instead, intensely and deeply, what she wanted, this bearded fisherman who had been to the war, and on occasion, if she pressed him, spoke about it without exaggerating. She stroked the top of his head with her fingers and felt the odd sensation of his beard against her breasts. "Carl," she whispered. But there was nothing to follow that with. She didn't know what other words she wanted to speak. After a while he stopped and pressed his hands against the bark of the cedar tree behind her so that his blunt, muscled arms passed on either side of her head. He looked at her closely, with an intimacy and seriousness that did not seem to embarrass him, this somber man, then tucked a strand of blonde hair in behind her ear. He kissed her, and then, still looking into her eyes, unbuttoned two of the buttons on her blouse, and kissed her again so that she was caught gently between Carl and the tree. She pushed back against him with the muscles of her pelvis, something she'd never done with a man before. It was an admission of her desire, a revealing of it, and it surprised her to the root of her being. Yet in another way, she was not surprised at all to find herself at the age of 20 pressing herself against Carl Heine beneath a cedar above the Westport Jensen dance pavilion. After all, she had brought this about, willed it into being. She had discovered when she was 17 that she could shape the behavior of men with her behavior, and that this ability was founded on her appearance. She was no longer astonished to look in the mirror and find she had developed the breasts and hips of an attractive grown-up woman. Her astonishment gave way quickly to happiness about it. There was a roundness and firmness to her, a clean, strong roundness. And her heavy blonde hair cast a glow over her shoulders when she wore a bathing suit. Her breasts turned just slightly away from one another and brushed against the insides of her arms when she walked. They were large, and when she got over her embarrassment about them, she was able to take pleasure in the fact that boys became unnerved in their presence. Yet Susan Marie never flirted. She did not let on she knew she was attractive. She went out with two boys before meeting Carl, and insisted on their politeness and reserve. Susan Marie did not want to be, foremost, a pair of breasts. But on the other hand, she was proud of herself. This pride remained with her into her mid-twenties, until she'd given birth to a second child, and her breasts were no longer so important to her as the most visible locus of her sexuality. Two sons had tugged at them with their gums and lips, and her breasts appeared different to her now. She wore a bra with stiff wire along its base in order to lift them up. Susan Marie knew, within 3 months of marrying Carl, that she'd made an excellent choice. In his grave, silent veteran's way, he was dependable and gentle. He was gone nights, fishing. He came home in the morning, ate and showered, and then they got into bed together. He kept his hands smooth with a pumice stone, so that even though they were fishermen's hands, they felt good stroking her shoulders. The two of them moved from position to position, trying everything. The sunlight just behind the pulled shade, their bodies moving in morning shadow but plainly visible. She found she had married an attentive man whose pursuit as a lover was to ensure her satisfaction. He read all her movements as signs, and when she was close to coming, retreated just enough so that her excitement became more desperate. Then it was necessary for her to put him on his back and rock high with her spine arched, while he, half sitting now, his stomach muscles clenched, stroked her breasts and kissed them. She often came this way, in control of her sensations, guiding herself along Carl's body. And Carl timed matters so as to begin to come while she was, and thus carry her back up so that when she was through, she did not feel satisfied, and was compelled to press on toward a second coming that the pastor at the First Hill Lutheran Church could neither approve nor disapprove of because, she felt certain of this, he had no idea that it was possible. Carl would sleep until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, then eat again and go out to work on the property. He was happy when she told him she was pregnant. He did not stop making love to her until she asked him to stop at the beginning of the 9th month. Sometime after their first son was born, Carl bought his own boat. When he named it for her, she was pleased and came aboard, and they took the baby out into the bay and west until the island was nothing but a low black line on the horizon. She sat on the short bunk nursing their son while Carl stood at the wheel. She sat there looking at the back of his head, his short tousled hair, the broad muscles in his back and shoulders. They ate a can of sardines, 2 pears, a bag of filberts. The baby slept on the bunk, and Susan Marie stood on a pallet board, piloting the boat while Carl, behind her, massaged her shoulders and the small of her back, and then her buttocks. She gripped the wheel more tightly when he lifted her skirt and slid her underpants out of the way, and then, leaning forward against the boat's wheel and reaching back to slide her hands along her husband's hips, she shut her eyes and rocked. These were the things Susan Marie remembered. In her estimation of it, their sex life had been at the heart of their marriage. It had permeated everything else between them, a state of affairs she sometimes worried over. If it went bad, would they go bad? Somewhere down the road, when they were older and less passionate, when their desire for one another had staled and worn out, then where would they be? She didn't even want to think about that or to mull how one day they might have nothing except his silence and his obsession with whatever he was working on, his boat, their house, his gardens. She could see her husband and Kabuo Miyamoto walking the border of the property. Then they went over a rise out of view, and she leaned down to stroke her baby's hair, so beautiful beneath her hand, and went downstairs again. In 20 minutes' time, Carl returned, alone, changed into a fresh T-shirt, and hunkered down on the front porch with his head in his hands. She came out with a cup of coffee in each hand and sat down next to him on his right. "What did he want?" she asked.
"Nothing,"
answered Carl. "We had some things to talk about, nothing much, no big deal. Susan Marie handed him a coffee cup. "It's hot," she said. "Be careful."
"All right," said Carl. "Thanks."
"I made him some," said Susan Marie. "I thought he was going to stay."
"It was nothing," said Carl. "It's a long story."
Susan Marie put her arm around his shoulder. "What's the problem?" she said.
"I don't know," sighed Carl. "He wants 7 of Old's acres. He wants me to let Old sell them to him, or sell them to him myself, you know, step out of his way."
7 acres?
The ones his family had. He wants them back. That thing my mother talks about.
"That," said Susan Marie. "I had a feeling it was that when he showed up."
"That," she added grimly.
Carl said nothing.
It was like him at a moment like this not to say very much. He didn't like to explain or elaborate, and there was a part of him she couldn't get to. She attributed this to his war experiences, and for the most part she let it be, this silence of his. But it irritated her at times.
"What did you tell him?" she asked now. "Did he go off angry, Carl?"
Carl set down his coffee.
He leaned his elbows against his knees.
"Damn," he answered. "What could I tell him? There's my mother to think about, you know her. I have to think about that business. If I let him get back in out there..."
He shrugged and seemed hapless for a moment. She saw the lines the sea wind had etched at the corners of his blue eyes.
"I told him I'd have to think it over, have a talk with you. Told him how upset my mother was with him, about his dirty looks and mean faces. He froze when I brought that up. Real polite, but frozen. Wouldn't look at me no more. Wouldn't come back up to the house for coffee. I don't know. I guess it was my fault. We got into a scrap, I guess. I couldn't talk with him, Susan. I just didn't know how to do it. I didn't know what to say to him."
He trailed off. She recognized it as one of his moments, thought it over, and held her tongue. It had never been very clear to her if Carl and Kabuo were friends or enemies. This was the first time she had seen them together, and it seemed to her, it was her impression, that there remained some measure of kind feelings between them. That after all this time they held inside at least the memory of their friendship. But there was no way, truly, of telling. It could be that their cordiality and handshaking had been nothing but stiff formality, that underneath they hated each other. She knew, anyway, that Carl's mother had nothing but ill feelings for all the Miyamotos. She sometimes spoke of them at the dinner table on Sundays, rattling on obsessively. Carl generally fell silent when this happened, or agreed with her in a perfunctory fashion, afterward dismissing the subject. Susan Marie had grown accustomed to these dismissals and to Carl's reluctance to speak about the matter. She was accustomed to it, but it pained her. And she wished she could clear it all up right now, while they sat together on the porch. The wind came up and tossed the tops of the alders, and she felt the odd fall warmth in it. Carl had told her more than once, he'd repeated it just the other day, how since the war he couldn't speak. Even his old friends were included in this, so that now Carl was a lonely man who understood land and work, boat and sea, his own hands, better than his mouth and heart. She felt sympathy for him, and rubbed his shoulder gently and waited patiently beside him.
"Damn," Carl said after a while. "Anyway, I guess as far as you're concerned, I could hand the whole business over to him and let him do what he wants with it. I guess you don't want to move out there anyway."
"It's so beautiful here," replied Susan Marie. "Just look around for a minute, Carl."
"Look around out there," he said. "That's 65 acres, Susan."
She understood that. He was a man who needed plenty of space, a vast terrain in which to operate. It was what he'd grown up with, and the sea, despite its size, was no substitute for green fields. Carl needed room. Far more room than his boat could offer, and anyway, in order to put his war behind him, the canton going down, men drowning while he watched, he would have to leave his boat for good and grow strawberries like his father. She knew this was the only way for her husband to grow sound. It was what made her willing, ultimately, to follow him out to Island Center.
"Supposing you sell him his 7 acres," Susan Marie said. "What's the worst your mother can do?"
Carl shook his head emphatically.
"It doesn't really come down to her," he said. "It comes down to the fact that Kabuo's a Jap. And I don't hate Japs, but I don't like 'em neither. It's hard to explain. But he's a Jap."
"He's not a Jap," Susan Marie said.
"You don't mean that, Carl. I've heard you say nice things about him. You and he were friends."
"Were," said Carl. "That's right, a long time ago. Before the war came along. But now, I don't like him much anymore. Don't like how he acted when I told him I'd think it over. Like he expected me to just hand those 7 acres to him, like I owed it to him, or..."
There was a boy's cry from the back of the house then, a cry of pain instead of argument or upset, and Carl was already moving toward it before Susan Marie could stand. They found their older boy sprawled on a flagstone with his left foot gripped in both his hands. He'd sliced it open against the sharp edge of a strut on the overturned wheelbarrow beside him. Susan Marie knelt and kissed his face and held him closely while his foot bled. She remembered how Carl had looked at the wound. Tenderly, transformed. He was no longer a war veteran. They'd taken the boy in to Dr. Whaley, and then Carl had gone off fishing. The two of them hadn't discussed Kabuo Miyamoto again, and Susan Marie soon recognized that the subject was somehow forbidden. It was forbidden in her marriage to open up her husband's wounds and look at them unless he asked her to. Their marriage, she understood after Carl was gone, had largely been about sex. It had been about sex right up to the end, until the day Carl went out of her life. That morning, while the children slept, they'd shut the bathroom door and pulled the latch and taken off their clothes. Carl showered, and Susan Marie joined him when the stink of salmon had been washed down the drain. She washed his large penis and felt it harden in her fingers. She put her arms around his neck, locked her feet at the small of his back. Carl held her up with his strong hands clenching the muscles in her legs and leaned the side of his face against her breasts and took to licking them. They moved that way, standing up in the bathtub with the water pouring over them, and Susan Marie's blonde hair pasted to her face and her hands clutched around her husband's head. They washed each other afterward, taking their time about it in the friendly way of certain married people, and then Carl got into bed and slept until 1 in the afternoon. At 2, having eaten a lunch of fried eggs and Jerusalem artichokes, canned pears and bread spread with clover honey, he went out to change the oil in his tractor. She saw him from the kitchen window that afternoon, gathering early windfall apples and dropping them in a burlap bag. At 3:45 he came up to the house again and said goodbye to the children, who were seated on the porch drinking apple juice and eating graham crackers and rolling pebbles back and forth. He came into the kitchen, wrapped himself around his wife, and explained that unless the fishing was excellent, he was coming home early the next morning. Would be home, he hoped, by 4 a.m. Then he left for the Amity Harbor docks. And she never saw him again. Chapter 21 Nels Gudmundsson stood at a distance from the witness stand when it was his turn to question Susan Marie Heine. He did not want to appear lecherous by placing himself in close proximity to a woman of such tragic, sensual beauty. He was self-conscious about his age, and felt that the jurors would see him as disgusting if he didn't distance himself from Susan Marie Heine and appear in general detached from the life of his body altogether. The month before, Nels had been told by a doctor in Anacortes that his prostate gland had become moderately enlarged. It would have to be removed surgically, and he would no longer be able to produce seminal fluid. The doctor had asked Nels embarrassing questions, and he had been forced to reveal a truth about which he was ashamed, that he could no longer achieve an erection. He could achieve one briefly, but it would wither in his hand before he had a chance to take pleasure from it. The bad part was not really this, so much as it was that a woman like Susan Marie Heine inspired a deep frustration in him. He felt defeated as he appraised her on the witness stand. It was no longer possible for him to communicate to any woman, even those his own age he knew in town, his merit and value as a lover, for he no longer had this sort of worth and had to admit as much to himself. As a lover, he was entirely through. Nels remembered as he watched Susan Marie Heine the finest years of his sex life, now more than a half a century behind him. He could not quite believe that this was so. He was 79 and trapped inside a decaying body. It was difficult for him to sleep and to urinate. His body had betrayed him, and most of the things he once took for granted were no longer even possible. A man might easily be embittered by such circumstances, but Nels made it a point not to struggle unnecessarily with life's unresolvable dilemmas. He had indeed achieved a kind of wisdom, if you wanted to call it that, though at the same time he knew that most elderly people were not wise at all, but only wore a thin veneer of cheap wisdom as a sort of armor against the world. Anyway, the kind of wisdom younger people sought from old age was not to be acquired in this life, no matter how many years they lived. He wished he could tell them this without inviting their mockery or their pity. Nels's wife had died from cancer of the colon. They had not gotten along particularly well, but nevertheless, he missed her. Occasionally, he sat in his apartment and wept, in order to empty himself of self-pity and remorse. Occasionally he attempted, unsuccessfully, to masturbate, in the hope of rediscovering that lost part of himself he deeply, achingly missed. He was convinced at rare moments that he could succeed, and that his youth was still buried inside of himself. The rest of the time, he accepted this as untrue, and went about the business of consoling himself in various unsatisfying ways. He liked to eat. He enjoyed chess. He did not mind his work, and knew himself to be quite good at it. He was a reader, and recognized his habit of reading as obsessive and neurotic, and told himself that if he read something less frivolous than newspapers and magazines, he might indeed be better off. The problem was that he could not concentrate on literature, however much he might admire it. It wasn't that War and Peace bored him exactly, but rather that his mind couldn't focus on it. Another loss. His eyes provided him with only half a view of the world, and reading caused his neurasthenia to flare up and made his temples throb. His mind, too, was failing him. He felt, although one could not be sure of such a thing. Certainly his memory was not as good as it had been when he was younger. Nels Gudmundsson tucked his thumbs in behind his suspenders and looked with studied detachment at the witness.
"Mrs. Heine," he said, "the defendant here appeared on your doorstep on Thursday, September 9th. Is that what I heard you say?"
"Yes, Mr. Gudmundsson, that's right."
He asked to speak to your husband?
He did.
They walked outside in order to talk. They didn't speak in the house.
Correct, said Susan Marie. They spoke outside. They walked our property for 30 or 40 minutes.
I see, said Nels. And you didn't accompany them?
No, said Susan Marie. I didn't.
Did you hear any part of their conversation?
No.
In other words, you have no first-hand knowledge of its content. Is that correct, Mrs. Heine?
What I know is what Carl told me, answered Susan Marie. I didn't hear their conversation, no.
Thank you, Nels said. Because that concerns me. The fact that you've testified about this conversation without having heard any part of it.
He pinched the wattles of skin at his throat and turned his good eye on Judge Fielding. The judge, his head resting on his hand, yawned and looked back with detachment.
Well, then, Nell said, to summarize, Mrs. Heine, your husband and the defendant walked and talked, and you stayed behind. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
And after 30 to 40 minutes, your husband returned. Is that also right, Mrs. Heine?
Yes, it is.
You asked him about the content of his conversation with the defendant?
Yes.
And he replied that the two of them had discussed the land in question, the land that your mother-in-law sold to old Jurgensen more than a decade ago, the land on which the defendant's childhood home sat. Is all of that right, Mrs. Heine?
Yes, said Susan Marie, it is.
You and your husband had recently put down earnest money on this land. Is that correct, Mrs. Heine?
Yes, my husband had.
"Let's see," said Nels Goodmanson. "Monday, September 6th, was Labor Day. Tuesday the 7th, Mr. Jurgensen put his land up for sale. Was it Wednesday, then, the 8th of September, that your husband signed the contract on Mr. Jurgensen's property?"
"It must have been," said Susan Marie. "Wednesday the 8th sounds right."
And the defendant visited the next day, on Thursday, the 9th of September?
Yes.
All right, then, said Nels Goodmanson. You've testified that on the afternoon of the 9th, the defendant presented himself at your door, and that he and your husband walked and talked, but that you were not present during their conversation. Do I have that right, Mrs. Heine?
Yes, you do.
And furthermore, said Nels, after the defendant left that afternoon, you and your husband sat on the porch and had your own conversation?
Yes.
Your husband indicated an unwillingness to talk about the content of his conversation with the defendant?
Correct.
You pressed him?
I did.
He reported to you that he had indicated to the defendant a willingness to think matters over?